Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
On November 8, 2018, the town of Paradise, California was devastated by the ferocious campfire, which burned down virtually every home and killed at least 85 people. My guests today are authors of a dramatic narrative of the disaster based on interviews with residents, firefighters, police officers, and scientific experts. Alistair G. was brought up in Manchester, England, by parents who believed he was capable of whatever he set his mind to. He is an award-winning editor and reporter at The Guardian, who has also written for The New Yorker Online, The New York Times, and The Economist. After college, he wanted to write and live abroad. He went to Russia for a language course and was offered a copy editing job at the Moscow Times and learned how to be a journalist. His 4 years in Moscow included an arrest by Russian police. He next landed in San Francisco and now works for The Guardian. Alistair G., welcome.
Thank you. What an introduction.
Well, I mean, I don't know many people have been arrested by Russian police. So that sounds like a story in itself.
Yeah.
And then Alistair G.'s co-author, Danny Anguiano, attended Chico State University and worked on the student newspaper, The Orion. She was a reporter for the Enterprise Record when she lived in Chico. She got a graduate degree in journalism from Northwestern University, and after she finished school, she was hired by the Chico Enterprise Record and was a reporter there for 3 years, and then joined the West Coast office of The Guardian. Danny Anguiano, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
These two reporters, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, are co-authors of a book about the campfire, Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. So this was quite an impressive book. I just enjoyed it so much. I read it more than once, many parts of it. And this, we refer to this as the campfire, but I don't know that many people know why it's called a campfire.
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual name, and it has to do with California's sort of interesting method for naming fires, and that's because it originally started over on Camp Creek Road, which is kind of near Polga in the foothills there, and that's how it got its name. And it confused a lot of people initially because they thought it was caused by a campfire, which, as we know, it wasn't. It was caused by that PG&E transmission line.
Yeah, because campfire sounds rather, oh, that was nice, and people were out camping and their fire got out of hand. Well, the research you put into this was quite impressive, and you bring us statistics like what firefighting costs in California and how the cost for fighting fires has been rising. And how fast did the expense of fighting fires rise in California?
In the summer of the campfire, Cal Fire, by the time of the campfire, had already exhausted its allotted firefighting budget that year and had to request more, an additional almost $500 million, I believe. And so firefighting expenses have soared. If you recall, the summer before the campfire was the summer that we also saw the terrible fire tornado in Redding, California. And so we've really been seeing these apocalyptic, very, very large fires increasing. In fact, scientists have a name for these fires. They call them megafires. And with megafires, of course, you're going to have mega costs to fight the fires.
Yeah, you say that the cost for fighting fires in California rose from $90 million in 2010 to $947 million in the fiscal year 2018, which ended in June of 2018. And so you say that summer, the state fire agency had to request additional funding after it spent $432 million in just 2 months. That was fighting the Mendocino Complex fire. And it's just, it doesn't seem to be getting better. My guests are reporters for The Guardian, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. And the book that you have written about the Paradise Fire is so such an interesting book. You go into the history of Paradise as a gold rush town. And Danny, since you lived in this area, you may have already known about the history of the Paradise as a gold rush town.
Yeah, that's right. I was quite familiar with Paradise's history. I lived in Chico for a long time. I graduated from Chico High School, and so I was very familiar with Paradise and its role in the area's history. And that's one of the things that Alistair and I really wanted to capture. You know, having known this town before the fire, everything it was before November 8th, that beautiful little town nestled in the foothills, surrounded by millions of trees, it was important to us to tell that story as well of what kind of town was this and how did it come to be that town over the last 150, 200 years and further back.
So you go into that history of Paradise as a gold rush town and that it is a 20-minute drive from the huge agricultural Central Valley of California. And the road that leads up from Chico into Paradise is called Skyway. And it goes up into the Sierra Nevada foothills. And describe the lay of the land and why that contributed to the problem of the fire.
Well, Skyway, as you mentioned, it's a really beautiful name for a road. And it leads up up to the Paradise Ridge. And as you drive up, you see these incredible canyons opening up on either side of the road. And those canyons girdle Paradise. Paradise was in the middle of them. And so, firstly, it's a dangerous position for several reasons. Firstly, it's in an elevated position. Paradise was at an altitude, and fire wants to go up. So that's just it's a place fire is naturally going to travel to. Those ridges also meant that the methods of exiting Paradise in case of an emergency were limited. You couldn't really go north. There was a road that leads north from Paradise into the mountains, but it wasn't designed for lots of traffic. And so there were only really three or four main roads leading south out of town. And what we saw in the campfire was that this fire swept over the ridge so quickly that roads out of town were quickly blocked or became gridlocked with traffic. And so escaping from Paradise became this incredibly terrifying scenario where, the roads were just jammed with traffic. And so people sat in their cars for hours and hours as the fire burned on either side of them. Sometimes cars on the road caught fire, so people had to abandon their vehicles. But it's just a very, very bad position for a town, owing just to the fact that it was very hard, in the case of a disaster, to get on and off that ridge.
And, you make the point, too, that these Native Americans who live there, you say California's pre-contact Native Americans, may have deployed fire as an ally, but it long ago came to be seen as a bogeyman in the U.S., and then there were devastating wildfires. You say in 1910, 78 firemen were killed. The U.S. Forest Service adopted an uncompromising approach. And what did they do then? What did they do to combat this bogeyman?
Tony, do you want to take that or shall I take that?
Why don't you take that one?
After some terrible, terrible fires in the early 20th century, we adopted as a nation, really, this different philosophy to dealing with fires. The U.S. Forest Service, in fact, in the 1930s, enacted this policy called the 10 a.m. policy. And that was the idea that by 10 a.m. the next day, any fire would be put out. And it later adopted a so-called 10-acre policy, saying that fires should be stopped from growing beyond that size. And so we really started to see fire as an enemy that had to be vanquished. And these ideas were galvanized after World War II. We had these terrible images in the news of fire bombings in cities like Dresden and Tokyo. And so fire, instead of being seen as an ally, as it had been by Native Americans earlier, and even by European and American settlers who used fire productively on the land, it began to be seen as something that had to be stamped out at all costs. And we were very successful at this. But throughout much of the 20th century, but that had consequences. And one of the consequences was that without fire, the landscape and the vegetation on the landscape became much thicker and more dense than it had been historically. There were no regular low-intensity fires to burn off the brush and the saplings and whatnot. And so it meant that by the end of the 20th century and in the beginning of our century and into the 2010s, when there are fires, they tend to burn much more hotter and much more intensely because there's just a greater buildup of vegetation and brush on the land. And another issue that we should mention is climate change. And California has seen several of its hottest ever years in the last decade or so. The snowpack in the Sierra is smaller. It's receding earlier than it has historically. So you just add the conditions in the forests with the conditions of the climate, and you really have a recipe, thanks to this legacy of firefighting and the success of firefighting, you have a recipe for disaster.
My guests are Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, who are reporters for The Guardian, who have written a book about the campfire that destroyed Paradise, California. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guests, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, co-authors of Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. And people know the destruction in Paradise, but often overlooked, I think, is the little town of Concow and how it suffered. And you tell the story of a woman in Concow. You give an example. You say, like many of her neighbors in Concow, Joanna Curtin was off the grid. She was a woman in her 60s who lived without electricity in a mobile home on 160 acres. She was born in Malaysia to English parents, attended school in the UK, and as a 21-year-old, met an American stationed at an Air Force base near the town of Ipswich. And then they moved to the US together. But he died. He fell off from a military truck, and she came to Concow. Now, do you remember her story?
Yes.
Would you tell us what happened to her?
Yeah, Joanna Curtin, a wonderful and lovely lady, lived on this very large spread of land. And she told me that she was just bewitched by the beauty of Concow. It's a somewhat isolated valley. You travel quite a winding road to get into it. And once you arrive, it feels like you've arrived in a little Switzerland. There's a beautiful, deep reservoir in the middle of this valley, ringed by hills and mountains and trees. It's extremely bucolic. And Joanna Curtin lived there. She had an assistant who lived on a property with her. And on the day of the fire, there was also, she had a visitor who was staying with her. His name was Crystal Dave, and he got that nickname because he wore a very large crystal around his neck that he believed would protect him. On the morning of the fire, Joanna woke up, and one of the first things she saw as the fire got closer was a fire tornado across the road from her. Fire tornadoes occur when you have essentially winds that spin the fire into a twister. And she saw a fire tornado across the road from her. It was throwing pieces of wood and bits of vegetation towards her, almost as if it was aiming for her, and it seemed to be coming towards her. So she told these two men on a property, "It's time for us to go, let's go." She had several vehicles. They all took one and they headed out onto the roads. There was smoke all around them. It was getting darker. They could see the fire in the hills around them. And so Joanna was traveling with these two guys in separate cars behind her. And she suddenly decided that she had to go and check on her horses, which were in a field nearby. So she suddenly split off and, she left Crystal Dave behind in one of the cars. And what she didn't realize at that time was that Crystal Dave got into a road accident. He came off the road, hit a tree, and he died. She continued to go and look for her horses. She entered a very, very thick patch of smoke. And all of a sudden, she collided with another car. Her airbags came out. She broke several ribs. A lot of the teeth in her mouth, she broke several of her top teeth. And when the smoke cleared, she was still buckled into a car. She couldn't get the door open. And luckily her assistant was following behind her, and he pulled her out of her car. She got onto the back of the quad bike that he was on. She was in incredible pain. Her ribs were broken. They were jostling about in her chest. It was hard to breathe. Her hair was catching on fire from the embers. And she and her assistant sped out of that pall of smoke. And all of a sudden, thankfully, they came out into the sunlight. They'd momentarily escaped the fire. They found some firefighters. And they were able to get Joanna to the hospital. Joanna just, she was traveling with some friends, some people she'd met to the hospital. She told his friends, "It's going to get paradise. It's going too quickly." And of course, that's exactly what happened.
My guests are reporters for The Guardian who have written a book, Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. And Alistair G has just been telling us about a woman in Concow and what she experienced that day. Well, we have, ever since I've been on the radio, we've had, from time to time, we would air announcements about what to do in an emergency. If this had been a real emergency, you would have been given instructions, et cetera. And there was not, it sounds like there were problems with the warning system in Paradise. What was the problem with the warning system there?
There were a few issues with the warning system there. The first being that the town of Paradise was used to fire. It had grown accustomed to wildfires burning in the area for many years. So it wasn't necessarily, you know, the smell of smoke that got people to panic. The town had prepared for an evacuation. It had done practice evacuations. It had this warning system that you mentioned established. But Paradise had never prepared for a fire of this magnitude. And to be fair, no city had. No city had a plan for what would happen if a fire swept over, you know, its entire mass at once. And so they started sending out warnings to people to evacuate from their various zones. And what we saw from there is that the people who actually got the warnings, because not everyone did, and that's because this was an opt-in system that people had to sign up for, and also because there was a real issue with getting some of the warnings out. And some of the theories behind that are that the fire actually, you know, destroyed cell phone towers. And so these warnings just weren't going through. But for the ones that did, and even for people who got warnings from other places, what we saw is that tens of thousands of people basically poured onto Paradise Roads all at the same time, desperate to escape. Fire at this point is burning through the town in various spots. The sky is filling with smoke. People can see that this is a pretty, you know, fast moving, dangerous situation. But even with those warnings, you know, when you have tens of thousands of people that pour onto just a few roads at the same time, what we saw is gridlock. And it was basically, you know, unavoidable.
Well, you say in the book that less than half of the 27,000 residents of Paradise had signed up to receive these alerts in the first place. And that's a problem that plagues these systems. You mentioned where people have to opt in. And so less than half of the residents had signed up for that. And then more than half of the 4,272 alert calls failed because the phones had been disconnected, numbers had changed, or cell towers didn't work. And you say that they may have been burned or overloaded by the flood of alerts put through the system. And in the western portion of town, three zones did not receive orders to go. So in total, you say only 6,200 people in Paradise received official warnings about this wildfire that was approaching. And you say most of the residents learned about it from neighbors or sirens or lines of cars in the street. And you say that one woman got an alert to evacuate as she stood outside her childhood home watching it burn.
It's an interesting question, which we came back to a lot. And I suppose the question is, how much are Paradise emergency officials, are they to blame for what happened? Should they have operated differently? And I think the conclusion that we came to, and that also the experts we spoke to also echoed, was that it would be unfair to blame people for an event that no one really thought was possible. As Danny mentioned, Paradise did have an emergency plan. Not many cities in California's Sierra foothills do. It was comprehensive. They had practiced. They had drills. And so Paradise was more prepared than many. And in this situation, the system did fail, but that wasn't for want of preparation, for want of forethought. I suppose you could argue that in the wake of, for instance, the Redding fire tornado, that Paradise should have been preparing for mega fires rather than regular fires. And in fact, some people in town were saying that. But we have to remember that even firefighters in CAL FIRE that we spoke to told us that they were continually surprised by how large California fires were growing. I remember speaking to a former firefighter who was, in fact, Paradise's emergency plan coordinator. He helped formulate the emergency plan. And he told me that in the 1970s, he worked on a fire, I believe in Shasta County. And it was 1 to 2,000 acres, as I recall. And at that time, that was a big fire. And of course, in the footprint of the Paradise fire, in the footprint of the car fire, that fire, he told us, it's just a dot. It was so hard for people with experience of what fires used to be like in California to comprehend that fires today in California were just several orders of magnitude. Coming back to this question of, well, should Paradise officials have been better prepared? I think it's hard to prepare for what you don't know is possible.
Yeah. Well, you tell the stories of various people that you apparently interviewed, and then you said that emergency dispatchers were fielding calls from panicked residents. And you mentioned this woman named Anne who called 911 because she didn't have a car in which to evacuate. And the evacuation plan assumes that you've got some kind of transportation. And she said she couldn't leave with her neighbors because they wouldn't take her dogs. And then the dispatcher tells her, ma'am, you need to save your own life. I understand your dogs are precious to you, but you need to save your own life. And then they said they would let the police department know you're having a hard time. But the dispatcher said, I can't guarantee we can get anyone there to help you. So you probably should go with the neighbors, okay? And of course, the woman began to cry. And the dispatcher told them to leave her dogs inside, leave them water and food, and go. said, do you understand me, Anne? This is a serious fire. I need you to leave the dogs with some water, close all the windows and doors, and get in the neighbor's car. I need you to do that. You need to do that right now, okay? And so this dispatcher is telling this woman she has to leave her dogs. And I have friends, their dogs are part of their family. They don't want to leave their animals. And even this woman in Concow, she had four horses that she was concerned about. What provisions were made for people to get out with their animals? Some people apparently did and some did not. What stories did you hear about that?
Yeah, even hearing you read that 911 call makes me emotional listening to it, because you just see that people were confronted with impossible choices. Many people really do think of their pets as like family. And so to have to just go, it's a hard decision to make. And we heard a lot of stories like that. One woman that day, her name was Sky, who we spoke to for this book. Her father woke her up that morning and told her about the fire and told her that, you know, she needed to leave because he knew it was going to be a bad one. And so Sky and her dog, they eventually started walking. That was how they left town. She wasn't going to leave her dog. You know, they would go everywhere together. She really loved her dog. They're very close. And so she and her dog left, but she was, you know, confronted with another difficult choice, which was that her father told her that he was going to stay. Her father, John Sedwick, was a former volunteer firefighter. And he decided that day that he was going to stay and scope things out. And so she had to leave with her dog, you know, leaving her 82-year-old father behind, who was very stubborn and wasn't going to leave, and not knowing how things would turn out. And I think that story we saw just repeated itself across the ridge of people struggling to get a hold of their loved ones or getting them to leave, or, you know, struggling to get out with their animals that are so near and dear to them.
I happened to be in a feed store here in Chico not long after that, and this woman was so concerned with the poor animals, deer animals that were starving after the fire, and she wanted to buy food for them. And we our heart goes out to people with their domestic pets, but then the wild animals suffered too in this. The book we're talking about is Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy, by reporters for The Guardian, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. Also, people were called in to help from outlying areas. For example, you tell the story of a CAL FIRE bulldozer operator named Joe Kennedy, who lived in Nevada City, and he was at work at his fire station there in Nevada City, which would be a 75-mile drive southeast of Paradise in these same foothills. And what was his story?
Joe Kennedy he's basically an iron column of a man. He's very, very tall, very, very strong. He has quite a stoic exterior. And he drives a bulldozer for CAL FIRE. Now, normally, bulldozers operate on the outskirts of a fire. They bulldoze fire line to stop a fire spreading. On this occasion, as you mentioned, he was 75 miles south of the fire. When he got the alert, he immediately drove his truck with the bulldozer attached up to Paradise. And while everyone else was pouring out of Paradise trying to escape, he was one of the people running towards danger, as they say. He pulled up outside the hospital, unloaded his bulldozer. And as I said, this was an unusual place for him to be. He wasn't this time on the outskirts of the fire. He was right in the middle of the fire. And he got to work doing what he knew best, which was essentially trying to clear pathways and basically move things that were burning out of the way to stop the fire spreading or to create exit paths for people. And while he was doing that, he heard over the radio a distress call from another engine. And this engine, it had sitting in the cab, there were several firefighters and there were also some nurses that had been rescued. and this fire engine was trapped. There were burning cars all around it that people had abandoned, and the fire engine was hedged in. There was no way it could leave, and they were afraid they were going to be burned over. And so Joe Kennedy did this astonishing thing. He went looking for it, even though he didn't know exactly where they were. He cleared dozens of cars, some of them burning, off the road. And he noticed, to his horror, that some of these cars contained human remains of people that hadn't been able to escape. He told me that's something that he'll never, ever be able to forget, and that he even finds it hard to forgive himself for having to push those cars off the road, even though we all know that he had to as part of his job to rescue people. So he cleared these dozens of cars, and eventually he was able to find the trapped fire engine, where it was so hot that the plastic was melting, the paint was peeling off the cab. They really thought that it was, the time had come, but he was able to free this bulldozer and the car of another nurse who was trapped, and they were able to escape. And Joe continued fighting that fire for days and days afterwards. And he went back home afterwards, and I met him several months after the fire. I visited him in his fire station, and it was that feeling of a fire station, a wildfire firefighting station in the off season. It was quiet, it was winter, and he told me this thing that I'll never forget. He said that the Paradise Fire had taught him that anywhere in the foothills was vulnerable. Now, he lived in the Grass Valley, Nevada City area. And he said, I now think that kind of fire could come for me. And I told my wife and my daughter, we have to be ready. And when the fire comes, you don't go looking for things. You don't go packing stuff. You leave everything and you just go.
Well, the stories that you tell in this book are just, they are heart-wrenching. And it's an emotional read to read your book. And you mentioned this bulldozer operator, and the bulldozers have a role in containing, when we use that label, containing a fire. And you define what is meant by contain when we say a fire is contained. And what are we referring to?
When a fire line has essentially been dug around the perimeter of a fire, boxing it in. So a fire is 100% contained if it's completely boxed in by fire line that's been dug around the outside of it.
Well, you have a story of a woman, Rochelle Sanders, who had just had a C-section. She'd just delivered this baby when she's ordered to evacuate. And we don't know how, I mean, we read through your book, and a lot of these stories, you tell part of it, and then we're wondering, well, what happened? Did she, did the baby survive? Did she survive? Because here she is hooked up to this, she's getting intravenous fluids, and 20 hours after giving birth, it took her 8 hours to evacuate from Feather River Hospital, but then she did reach Enloe Hospital, and that too, we're in suspense. How can they transport this woman? Because ambulances aren't available. And
it's a really incredible story. And I think Rochelle's story shows the incredible things that were happening at the hospital that morning. To give you a little background on that, what happened was at the hospital, you know, they staff were made aware of a fire in the area. And this is a hospital that, as I mentioned, like the rest of Paradise, was accustomed to fire. But when staff started seeing burning leaves falling on the hospital grounds and other, you know, debris blowing in, that's when they understood that they were probably going to have to evacuate. And so that morning, they had a meeting, and just, you know, before 8 a.m., they decided, you know, we need to get everyone out. They had just under 70 patients. And as you mentioned, they had no ambulances. And so they tried to call ambulances in, but staff just arranged this incredible operation of immediately evacuating all of these patients, some who, you know, had been put under anesthesia for surgeries, and some, you know, like Rochelle, who had just given birth the night before. And because they didn't have ambulances, they put patients in their own cars and drove out with them. So Rochelle, you know, and her newborn found themselves in the car of a hospital worker named Dave, who Rochelle remembers as being, you know, perhaps the hospital's maintenance engineer. She is still wearing her hospital gown, and as you said, has her IV fluids hooked up to the rearview mirror and this newborn baby on her lap. And she understands that things are very dire. And she has two other kids who also need to get out. And, you know, her husband is evacuating, the kids are evacuating, and she is in this car with this man trying to leave. And she encounters quite a bit of trouble, you know, streets completely clogged, fire burning around her. And she's just, she and Dave are just driving circles around the town trying to find a way out. She eventually drives by her own home, or what was her home, and sees that it's gone. It was a home that had been in her family for a long time. It belonged to her grandparents. So she learns that's gone, and she experiences hell that day, you know, wondering if she and this newborn baby are going to make it. And even telling the person she's in the car with that, that if they need to get out and run, that he needs to take the baby because she won't be able to run and she won't make it. But eventually, after this incredibly long day, they make it to the hospital. She's reunited with her husband and her family, and she realizes that she's okay and that she has survived.
After a break, I'll be back with reporters Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, co-authors of A Book on the Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, reporters for The Guardian, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, co-authors of Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. Now, there's a heartwarming, just a short little paragraph in your book about Butte County Sheriff, whose name we came to know, one of the heroes. But there's a 24-year-old Paradise police officer, the only woman on the patrol force, and her name is famous too. Who is she?
Her name is Cassidy. She is an officer with the Paradise police force, and she was called in to duty that day when she heard there was a fire. And as you mentioned, we have this scene in the book where she is trying to help people leave. She's trying to clear the roads. You know, she comes across drivers who are just so frozen in fear that they can't drive. And she has to tell them, look, you need to go or get out of the way because people need to leave. And so she's working all day and eventually finds herself at this intersection with an officer with the Butte County Sheriff's Office. And then he tells her that he has to go because he heard there were deputies trapped up north and he needs to go investigate. And he hugs her goodbye and says, you know, I'm so proud of you because this isn't just any man. This is Corey Honey, the Butte County Sheriff, her father. And so he too had a tough thing he had to do that day. He had to try to help this town and try to help people and also leave his daughter and you know, hope that she was going to get out safely and be able to do her job as well.
Yeah, it's such a sweet scene. I'm so proud of you, he said as he wrapped his arms around her. This was her father, the Butte County Sheriff, saying he was proud of his daughter, Cassidy. The stories that you tell also include information about the first firefighting plane and the problems with planes being able to help, or the highway patrol helicopters. The helicopters really couldn't help either, but highway patrol helicopters were sent to Concow to pick up burn victims. So we don't know about some of this that we don't see.
It was hard for aircraft to operate in the campfire. Very early that day, a firefighting reconnaissance plane did take off from the Chico Airport. There's a CAL FIRE base there to go and surveil the fire. And it just so happened that the person who was in charge, he actually had relatives in Paradise. And so he knew that he was looking at people he knew having to evacuate down there. But the first plane that followed and went to try and drop retardant on the landscape to try and stop the fire spread towards a emergency service communications tower, it started its drop procedure. It descended, but the winds were so strong that day that actually the plane was pushed upwards and it wasn't able to get close enough to the ground to be able to drop the retardant. And so very quickly they realized that aircraft weren't going to be an easy solution to put out the fire that day. And later in that day, helicopters were able to drop some water on the fire, and some helicopters were able to operate by ferrying victims to safety. But in general, this simply wasn't a fire, owing to the winds, that aircraft could operate in safely on a large scale.
Well, and then there comes the point where there's a new mission objective. Instead of restricting the fire to a specific area, the mission became evacuations. And the people who were on the scene really were there making their own decisions about that. There's a story that you tell about a disabled man named Andrew Downer. And he couldn't get out. He was in a wheelchair waiting on his porch for firefighters to come. And that's where they found his body in a burned wheelchair, his body burned in a wheelchair. I can only imagine what that was like for him and his family to know that that's...
Yeah, it's a terrible story. I spent a lot of time speaking with his partner of almost 30 years, Iris Natividad, and it just so happened that she has an office in Santa Rosa, so she wasn't in town that day. But she was in constant contact with Andrew once she'd heard there was a fire. Andrew's siblings were in touch with him, friends were in touch with him. And for a long time, from about 7:30 a.m. when people first got in touch with Andrew, it seemed like everything was going to be fine. Several people offered to come and pick him up because he was disabled. He was barely able to walk. He'd had a leg amputated. And he was just in a lot of discomfort, a lot of pain. He just had very, very limited mobility. And so, yeah, it seemed as though people were going to come and be able to help him. But as the hours ticked by, it turned out that the roads were blocked. The fire was so severe that, in fact, the people that they thought were going to be able to pick up Andrew weren't able to get to him. And in one of the last phone calls, his partner, Iris, told him, look, open the kitchen door so that the dogs can escape. Because she said, when the firefighters come and get you, they won't be able to take the dogs. And she still believed the firefighters would come. So she said, when the firefighters come. And she just told him to be ready on the doorstep, be visible, they'll come and get you. And that was really one of the last times she spoke to Andrew. And soon a deputy someone from the firefighting forces was sent to check on the property. And they discover that Andrew hadn't made it and was, in fact, still on his doorstep in his wheelchair waiting where Iris had told him to wait.
My guests are reporters for The Guardian, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, and their book is Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. And you've been recounting some of the tragedies. There was one story, though, that I found rather amusing. And this was this guy who was concerned about his wife, or his wife's name was Ellen. And he was so determined to go check on her And in spite of all the barricades that were set up, the police were not letting anybody through. And so what did he do?
Well, there were barricades.
Lonnie Walker, by the way. This is, he wants to get into Concal.
Yeah, Lonnie Walker, he drove a logging truck. And he left his home in Concal at about 3 a.m. that morning to go and drive his truck. And when he heard there was a fire, he drove immediately back. But a barricade had been set up around town because there were emergency operations going on inside. And the barricade remained because then there was a search and recovery operation. And there were presumably lots of bodies in the remains of the town. And so Lonnie wasn't able to see what had happened to his house. He hadn't heard from Ellen. And there had been a previous fire where communications had been cut off, but their house had been fine. And so he was hoping beyond hope that something similar had happened, that Ellen was simply still at home. She was cut off, but she was fine. And he just wasn't able to find out, though. And so a friend of his said, come on, Lonnie, let's figure out a way in. And so they drove around the back roads, around the barricade. They probed around, trying to find out somewhere where there weren't cops blocking the roads. They couldn't find anywhere. So they drove up to the main roadblock on Highway 70. And they, like an action movie, they basically burst through the roadblock and drove up Highway 70. His friend estimates at about 100 miles per hour. And the friend remembers looking in the rearview mirror and seeing that no one was following them. So he thought, yes, we made it. Then they got towards the top of the highway and there was another roadblock. And of course they had to pull over. The friend, Lonnie's friend, was pulled out of the car and put in handcuffs. And eventually Lonnie was able to explain why they were there, what they were looking for.
I mean, the officer was serious. They drew their guns.
They were very, very serious. But I think their hearts softened immediately when they heard Lonnie's story. And plus, Lonnie's friend, one of the cops, knew Lonnie's friend. Lonnie's friend had worked on the cop's boat, in fact. And so they were able to smooth over these hostilities in this very difficult situation. And Lonnie was escorted up to his house to see what had happened. Then his friend told me that, you know, he knew what Lonnie had found when he saw Lonnie coming back down again off the ridge and he saw the way his head was hanging low. And of course the news wasn't good. And, you know, Lonnie spent the night at his friend's house and, Lonnie was torn apart by what had happened. He told me that he'd had all these rough edges before he met Ellen. He was just, he was a guy's guy. He just, you know, he didn't know, like Ellen just taught him, she was a gentlewoman and she taught him how to be a gentleman. And the way he spoke about Ellen was just so touching and so polite and so affectionate. It brought a lump to my throat. And so Lonnie, he moved away from the area initially, but he's moved back since to the Paradise area. Actually, no, excuse me. I think he now lives, you might need to edit this bit out, but he's moved back closer to the Paradise area now because he realized he wanted to be near his relatives.
Well, we mentioned how many people were affected, and you say in your book, more than 50,000 people were displaced after the fire. Most converged on Chico, and we have a population of 90,000, and the Walmart became a refugee camp. But now something that kind of at the time, maybe not a registered with us as much as it does now, but you say that more or less 145 people in the shelters caught norovirus. It was highly contagious. And now when we hear of contagious virus, our ears are immediately notice that people in the shelters caught the norovirus. And of course, that was unfortunate. People are already suffering in the shelters. But I would like to give you a chance to mention people who not only did people in Chico open their hearts and homes to these evacuees, but there were donations that came in. And who were some of the people that donated?
That's right. There were so many donations that poured in from all over the state, but also locally too. There was, you know, Aaron Rodgers donated quite a bit of money, as did the Sierra Nevada Brewery. And there was also what came to be known as the Adopt-A-Family, which was a program started by this couple who wasn't from the area. They were from kind of near Sacramento. And they saw what was happening, and their, you know, their hearts were just broken over that. And so they started this Facebook page where they could match survivors who needed things with donors. So for instance, you know, there was a woman who really needed a breast pump to be able to feed her baby, and they were able to help her get that, you know, within a few hours. So there was just immediately this surge of support for people. And I got to see some of that firsthand in the early days after the fire, when I spent quite a bit of time at that Walmart just talking to people. And, you know, there were lots and lots of evacuees there, some of whom were sleeping in sleeping bags, in tents, and in their cars, just, you know, piled with whatever they could bring. But there were also a lot of people who just showed up there to help, to bring donations, to serve food. So there was so much generosity. One of the things that really touched me and boosted my spirits in those early days is I met these two people, Daryl and Tammy. They were roommates who, you know, fled Paradise together and then ended up sleeping in a tent outside the Walmart. And while they were at this Walmart, they ran into their neighbor, and they found out that he had nowhere to go and had been sleeping outside underneath a taco truck. And so even though their tent was quite small, they said, come on in, you don't need to sleep outside. And so the three of them piled into this tent, and there were just countless acts of generosity like this from people who had lost everything, who, you know, had just witnessed the destruction of their town and everything they held dear. And they were willing to give whatever they did have to help their neighbors and their friends.
Well, you mentioned Aaron Rodgers and making a donation. It was actually substantial. He donated $1 million to launch the Butte Strong Fund and assist with the rebuild. And so there are so many stories like that that are just so heartwarming that people did that to help out. I want to thank you for writing this book. It's so well written, and I'm sure people in this area will be so eager to read this book that you have written. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
My guests have been reporters for The Guardian, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano. Their book is Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.